fit the dining area without adequate explanation. But Estra had eaten no dinner at all, and had possibly disappointed some woman companion, also without adequate explanation. Doris Venneboli had not eaten either, and she seemed the most tense and unhappy of the three. She carried a thermal blanket and two photonic founts. When they reached the entrance to Upperside, Legan, jaw muscles tightening, entered his identification number, and the door opened. A cold wind rushed at them, and Banastra grunted. None of the three was adequately dressed, but the two men had no intention of remaining up there long. Doris said tightly, "It's snowing." Legan said, "It's wet snow. The temperature's just about at the freezing point. It's not a killing frost." "It depends on how long one remains in it, doesn't it?" said Doris. "And being soaked in melting snow won't help." Legan grunted. "Well, where is he?" He stared resentfully out into utter blackness, made even worse by the light from the entrance behind him. Doris said, "Here, Dr. Banastra, hold this blanket for me. And you, Dr. Legan, close the door behind you without locking it."
"There's no automatic lock on it. Do you think we're foolish?"
"Perhaps not. But you can lock it from the inside and leave anyone outside unable to get into the dome."
"If someone's outside, point him out. Show him to me," said Legan.
"He could be anywhere."
Doris lifted her arms with a photonic fount circling each wrist.
"We can't look everywhere," mumbled Banastra miserably.
The founts blazed into light, spraying in every direction. The snowflakes glittered like a vast mob of fireflies, making it even more difficult to see.
"The footsteps were getting steadily louder," said Doris. "He had to be approaching the transducer. Where would it be located?"
"I haven't any idea," snapped Legan. "That's outside my field and my responsibility."
"Dr. Banastra?"
Banastra's reply was hesitant.
"I don't really know. To tell you the truth, I've never been up here before. It was installed before my time. The computer knows, but we never thought to ask it that. I'm cold, and I don't see what use I am up here."
"You'll have to stay up here for a while," said Doris firmly. "Follow me. I'm going to circle the entrance in an outward spiral."
"We can't see much through the snow," said Legan.
"I know that. If it wasn't snowing, we'd have seen him by now. I'm sure of it. As it is, it may take a few minutes. We can stand that."
She was by no means as confident as her words made it appear. She began to walk, swinging her arms, playing the light over as large a field as she could, straining her eyes for a dark blotch against the snow. And, as it happened, it was Banastra who first said,
"What's that?"
and pointed. Doors overlapped the two founts, making a bright cone of light in the indicated direction. She ran toward it, as did the other two. They had found him, huddled and wet, about 10 meters from the door, 5 from the nearest meteorological device. Doris felt for his heartbeat, but it was not necessary, for responding to her touch, Selden stirred and whimpered.
"Give me the blanket, Dr. Banastra," said Doris in a voice that was faint with relief.
She flapped it open and spread it out in the snow.
"Lift him onto it carefully, and I'll wrap him. Then we'll carry him down."
In the elevator, vapors were rising from the wrapped Selden as the blanket warmed to blood temperature. Doris said,
Once we have him in his room, Dr. Lagan, you get a doctor, a good one, and see that he comes at once. If Dr. Selden gets through this without harm, I won't say anything, but only if he does. Remember...
You needn't lecture me, said Lagan coldly. I regret this, and I will do what I can. But my only fault was in allowing this man to come upperside in the first place.
The blanket stirred, and a low, weak voice made itself heard. But Astra started, for Selden's head was cradled in the crook of his elbow. He said,
He's trying to say something.
Doris said, I know. He said, What's going on? She couldn't help but laugh just a little. It seemed such a normal thing to say.
28.
The doctor was delighted. I've never seen a case of exposure, he explained. One doesn't get exposed on Trantor.
That may be, said Doris coldly, and I'm happy you have the chance to experience this novelty, but does it mean that you do not know how to treat Dr. Selden?
The doctor, an elderly man with a bald head and a small gray mustache, bristled. The doctor, an elderly man with a bald head and a small gray mustache, bristled.
Of course I do. Exposure cases on the outer worlds are common enough, an everyday affair, and I've read a great deal about them.
Treatment consisted in part of an antiviral serum and the use of a microwave wrapping.
This ought to take care of it, the doctor said. On the outer worlds, they make use of much more elaborate equipment in hospitals, but we don't have that, of course, on Trantor. This is a treatment for mild cases, and I'm sure it will do the job.
Doris thought later, as Selden was recovering without particular injury, that it was perhaps because he was an outworlder that he had survived so well. Dark, cold, even snow were not utterly strange to him. A Trantorian probably would have died in a similar case, not so much from physical trauma as from psychic shock. She was not sure of this, of course, since she herself was not a Trantorian either. And, turning her mind away from these thoughts, she pulled up a chair near to Harry's bed and settled down to wait.
29.
On the second morning, Selden stirred awake and looked up at Doris, who sat at his bedside, viewing a book film and taking notes. In a voice that was almost normal, Selden said, "Still here, Doris?" She put down the book film.
"I can't leave you alone, can I? And I don't trust anyone else."
"It seems to me that every time I wake up, I see you. Have you been here all the time?"
"Sleeping or waking, yes."
"But your classes?"
"I have an assistant who has taken over for a while."
Doris leaned over and grasped Harry's hand. Noticing his embarrassment, he was, after all, in bed, she removed it.
"Harry, what happened? I was so frightened."
Selden said, "I have a confession to make."
"What is it, Harry?"
"I thought perhaps you were part of a conspiracy."
"A conspiracy?"
she said vehemently. "I mean, to maneuver me upperside, where I'd be outside university jurisdiction, and therefore subject to being picked up by Imperial forces."
"But upperside isn't outside university jurisdiction. Sector jurisdiction on Trantor is from the planetary center to the sky."
"Ah, I didn't know that. But you didn't come with me because you said you had a busy schedule. And when I was getting paranoid, I thought you were deliberately abandoning me. Please forgive me. Obviously, it was you who got me down from there. Did anyone else care?"
"They were busy men," said Doris carefully. "They thought you had come down earlier.
I mean, it was a legitimate thought.
Clausia thought so too.
The young intern? Yes, she did.
Well, it may still have been a conspiracy. Without you, I mean.
No, Harry, it is my fault. I had absolutely no right to let you go Upperside alone. It was my job to protect you. I can't stop blaming myself for what happened, for you getting lost.
No, wait a minute, said Selden, suddenly irritated. I didn't get lost. What do you think I am?
I'd like to know what you call it. You were nowhere around when the others left, and you didn't get back to the entrance, or to the neighborhood of the entrance anyway, till well after dark.
But that's not what happened. I didn't get lost just because I wandered away and couldn't find my way back. I told you I was suspecting a conspiracy, and I had cause to do so. I'm not totally paranoid.
Well then, what did happen?
Selden told her. He had no trouble remembering it in full detail. He had lived with it in nightmare for most of the preceding day. Doris listened with a frown.
But that's impossible. A jet down? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. Do you think I was hallucinating?
But the Imperial forces could not have been searching for you. They could not have arrested you Upperside without creating the same ferocious rumpus they would have if they had sent in a police force to arrest you on campus.
Then how do you explain it?
I'm not sure, said Doris. But it's possible that the consequences of my failure to go Upperside with you might have been worse than they were, and that Hummin will be seriously angry with me.
Then let's not tell him, said Selden. It ended well.
We must tell him, said Doris grimly. This may not be the end.
30. That evening, Jannar Legan came to visit. It was after dinner, and he looked from Doris to Selden several times, as though wondering what to say. Neither offered to help him, but both waited patiently. He had not impressed either of them as being a master of small talk. Finally, he said to Selden,
I've come to see how you are.
Perfectly well, said Selden, except that I'm a little sleepy. Dr. Venabili tells me that the treatment will keep me tired for a few days, presumably so I'm sure of getting needed rest. He smiled. Frankly, I don't mind. Legan breathed in deeply, let it out, hesitated, and then, almost as though he was forcing the words out of himself, said,
I won't keep you long. I perfectly understand you need to rest. I do want to say, though, that I am sorry it all happened. I should not have assumed, so casually, that you had gone down by yourself. Since you were a Tyro, I should have felt more responsible for you. After all, I had agreed to let you come up. I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. That's really all I wish to say.
Selden yawned, putting his hand over his mouth. Pardon me. Since it seems to have turned out well, there need be no hard feelings. In some ways, it was not your fault. I should not have wandered away. And besides, what happened was...
Doris interrupted. Now, Harry, please, no conversation. Just relax. Now, I want to talk to Dr. Legan just a bit before he goes. In the first place, Dr. Legan, I quite understand you were concerned about how repercussions from this affair will affect you. I told you there would be no follow-up if Dr. Selden recovered without ill effects. That seems to be taking place, so you may relax, for now. I would like to ask you about something else, and I hope that this time I will have your free cooperation.
I will try,
Dr. Venabili, said Legan stiffly. Did anything unusual happen during your stay, Upperside?
You know it did. I lost Dr. Selden, something for which I have just apologized.
Obviously, I'm not referring to that. Did anything else unusual happen?
No, nothing. Nothing at all.
Doris looked at Selden, and Selden frowned. It seemed to him that Doris was trying to check on his story and get an independent account. Did she think he was imagining the search vessel? He would have liked to object heatedly, but she had raised a quieting hand at him, as though she was preventing that very eventuality. He subsided, partly because of this, and partly because he really wanted to sleep. He hoped that Legan would not stay long.
Are you certain? Said Doris. Were there no intrusions from outside?
No, of course not. Oh.
Yes, Dr. Legan?
There was a jet down.
Did that strike you as peculiar?
No, of course not.
Why not?
This sounds very much as though I'm being cross-examined, Dr. Venabili. I don't much like it.
I can appreciate that, Dr. Legan, but these questions have something to do with Dr. Selden's misadventure. It may be that this whole affair is more complicated than I had thought.
In what way? A new edge entered his voice. Do you intend to raise new questions, requiring new apologies? In that case, I may find it necessary to withdraw.
Not, perhaps, before you explain how it is you do not find a hovering jet down a bit peculiar.
Because, my dear woman, a number of meteorological stations on Trentor possess jet downs for the direct study of clouds and the upper atmosphere. Our own meteorological station does not.
Why not? It would be useful.
Of course, but we're not competing, and we're not keeping secrets. We will report on our findings. They will report on theirs. It makes sense, therefore, to have a scattering of differences and specializations. It would be foolish to duplicate efforts completely. The money and manpower we might spend on jet downs can be spent on Masonic refractometers, while others will spend on the first and save on the latter. After all, there may be a great deal of competitiveness and ill feeling among the sectors, but science is one thing, the only thing, that holds us together. You know that, I presume, he added ironically.
I do. But isn't it rather coincidental that someone should be sending a jet down right to your station on the very day you were going to use the station?
No coincidence at all. We announced that we were going to make measurements on that day, and consequently, some other station thought, very properly, that they might make simultaneous nephelometric measurements. Clouds, you know. The results taken together would make more sense and be more useful than either taken separately.
Selden said suddenly in a rather blurred voice, "They were just measuring then?" He yawned again.
Yes, said Legan. What else could they possibly be doing?
Doris blinked her eyes, as she sometimes did when she was trying to think rapidly.
That all makes sense. To which station did this particular jet down belong?
Legan shook his head.
Dr. Venabili, how can you possibly expect me to tell?
I thought that each meteorological jetdown might possibly have its station's markings on it.
Surely. But I wasn't looking up and studying it, you know. I had my own work to do, and I let them do theirs. When they report, I'll know whose jetdown it was.
What if they don't report?
Then I would suppose their instruments failed. That happens sometimes.
His right fist was clenched.
Is that all, then?
Wait a moment. Where do you suppose the jetdown might have come from?
It might be any station with jetdowns. On a day's notice, and they got more than that, one of those vessels can reach us handily from any place on the planet.
But who most likely?
Hard to say. Pestilonia, Y, Ziggurat, North Damanio. I'd say one of those four was the most likely, but it might be any of 40 others at least.
Just one more question, then. Just one. Dr. Lagan, when you announced that your group would be Upperside, did you by any chance say that a mathematician, Dr. Harry Seldon, would be with you?
A look of apparently deep and honest surprise crossed Lagan's face, a look that quickly turned contemptuous.
Why should I list names? Of what interest would that be to anyone?
Very well, said Doris. The truth of the matter, then, is that Dr. Seldon saw the jetdown and it disturbed him. I am not certain why, and apparently his memory is a bit fuzzy on the matter. He more or less ran away from the jetdown, got himself lost, didn't think of trying to return, or didn't dare to, till it was well into twilight, and didn't quite make it back in the dark.
You can't be blamed for that, so let's forget the whole incident on both sides. Agreed?
Agreed, said Lagan. Goodbye.
He turned on his heel and left. When he was gone, Doris rose, pulled off Seldon's slippers gently, straightened him in his bed, and covered him. He was sleeping, of course. Then she sat down and thought. How much of what Lagan had said was true, and what might possibly exist under the cover of his words? She did not know.
Mycogen. Mycogen, a sector of ancient Trantor. Buried in the past of its own legends, Mycogen made little impact on the planet. Self-satisfied and self-separated to a degree. Encyclopedia Galactica. 31. When Seldon woke, he found a new face looking at him solemnly. For a moment he frowned owlishly, and then he said, Haman? Haman smiled very slightly. You remember me then? It was only for a day, nearly 2 months ago, but I remember. You were not arrested then, or in any way. As you see, I am here, quite safe and whole. But, and he glanced at Doris, who stood to one side, it was not very easy for me to come here. Seldon said, I'm glad to see you. Do you mind, by the way? He jerked his thumb in the direction of the bathroom. Haman said, Take your time. Have breakfast. Haman didn't join him at breakfast, neither did Doris. Nor did they speak. Haman scanned a book film with an attitude of easy absorption. Doris inspected her nails critically, and then, taking out a microcomputer, began making notes with a stylus. Seldon watched them thoughtfully, and did not try to start a conversation. The silence now might be in response to some Trantorian reserve customary at a sickbed. To be sure, he now felt perfectly normal, but perhaps they did not realize that. It was only when he was done with his last morsel, and with the final drop of milk, which he was obviously getting used to, for it no longer tasted odd, that Haman spoke. He said, How are you, Seldon? Perfectly well, Haman. Sufficiently well, certainly, for me to be up and about. I'm glad to hear it, said Haman dryly. Doris Van Abbele was much to blame in allowing this to happen. Seldon frowned. No, I insisted on going Upperside.
I'm sure, but she should at all costs have gone with you.
I told her I didn't want her to go with me.
Dora said, That's not so, Harry. Don't defend me with gallant lies.
Selden said angrily, But don't forget that Dora's also came Upperside after me, against strong resistance, and undoubtedly saved my life. That's not bending the truth at all. Have you added that to your evaluation, Hummin?
Dora's interrupted again, obviously embarrassed.
Please, Harry. Cheddar Hummin is perfectly correct in feeling that I should either have kept you from going Upperside or have gone up with you. As for my subsequent actions, he has praised them.
Nevertheless, said Hummin, that is past, and we can let it go. Let us talk about what happened Upperside, Selden.
Selden looked about and said guardedly, Is it safe to do so?
Hummin smiled slightly. Dora's has placed this room in a distortion field. I can be pretty sure that no Imperial agent at the university, if there is one, has the expertise to penetrate it. You are a suspicious person, Selden.
Not by nature, said Selden. Listening to you in the park, and afterward, you are a persuasive person, Hummin. By the time you were through, I was ready to fear that Ato Demerzel was lurking in every shadow.
I sometimes think he might be, said Hummin gravely.
If he was, said Selden, I wouldn't know it was he. What does he look like?
That scarcely matters. You wouldn't see him unless he wanted you to, and by then it would all be over, I imagine, which is what we must prevent. Let's talk about that jet down you saw.
Selden said, As I told you, Hummin, you filled me with fears of Demerzel. As soon as I saw the jet down, I assumed he was after me, that I had foolishly stepped outside the protection of Streeling University by going Upperside, that I had been lured up there for the specific purpose of being picked up without difficulty.
Doris said, On the other hand, Lagan...
Selden said quickly, Was he here last night?
Yes, don't you remember?
Vaguely. I was dead tired. It's all a blur in my memory.
Well, when he was here last night, Lagan said that the jet down was merely a meteorological vessel from another station. Perfectly ordinary, perfectly harmless.
What? Selden was taken aback. I don't believe that.
Hummin said, Now, the question is, why don't you believe that? Was there anything about the jet down that made you think it was dangerous? Something specific, that is, and not just a pervasive suspicion placed in your head by me.
Selden thought back, biting his lower lip. He said, Its actions. It seemed to push its forepart below the cloud deck, as though it were looking for something. Then it would appear in another spot just the same way, then in another spot, and so on. It seemed to be searching Upperside methodically, section by section, and homing in on me.
Hummin said, Perhaps you were personifying Selden. You may have been treating the jet down as though it was a strange animal looking for you. It wasn't, of course. It was simply a jet down. And if it was a meteorological vessel, its actions were perfectly normal and harmless.
Selden said, It didn't seem that way to me.
Hummin said, I'm sure it didn't, but we don't actually know anything. Your conviction that you were in danger is simply an assumption. Lagan's decision that it was a meteorological vessel is also only an assumption.
Selden said stubbornly, I can't believe that it was an entirely innocent event.
Well then, said Hummin, suppose we assume the worst, that the vessel was looking for you. How would whoever sent that vessel know you would be there to seek?
Doris interjected.
I asked Dr. Legan if he had, in his report of the forthcoming meteorological work, included the information that Harry would be with the group. There was no reason he should, in the ordinary course of events, and he denied that he had, with considerable surprise at the question. I believed him.
Hammond said thoughtfully,
Don't believe him too readily. Wouldn't he deny it in any case?
Now, ask yourself why he allowed Selden to come along in the first place. We know he objected initially, but he did relent without much fight. And that, to me, seems rather out of character for Legan.
Doris frowned and said,
I suppose that does make it a bit more likely that he did arrange the entire affair. Perhaps he permitted Harry's company only in order to put him in the position of being taken. He might have received orders to that effect. We might further argue that he encouraged his young intern, Clausia, to engage Harry's attention and draw him away from the group, isolating him. That would account for Legan's odd lack of concern over Harry's absence when it came time to go below. He would insist that Harry had left earlier, something he would have laid the groundwork for, since he had carefully showed him how to go down by himself. It would also account for his reluctance to go back up in search of him, since he would not want to waste time looking for someone he assumed would not be found.
Hammond, who had listened carefully, said,
You make an interesting case against him, but let's not accept that too readily either. After all, he did come upperside with you in the end.
Because footsteps had been detected. The chief seismologist had borne witness to that.
Well, did Legan show shock and surprise when Selden was found? I mean, beyond that of finding someone who had been brought into extreme peril through Legan's own negligence. Did he act as though Selden wasn't supposed to be there? Did he behave as though he were asking himself, how is it they didn't pick him up?
Doris thought carefully, then said,
He was obviously shocked by the sight of Harry lying there, but I couldn't possibly tell if there was anything to his feelings beyond the very natural horror of the situation.
No, I suppose you couldn't.
But now Selden, who had been looking from one to the other as they spoke, and who had been listening intently, said,
I don't think it was Legan.
Hammond transferred his attention to Selden.
Why do you say that?
For one thing, as you noted, he was clearly unwilling to have me come along. It took a whole day of argument. And I think he agreed only because he had the impression that I was a clever mathematician who could help him out with meteorological theory. I was anxious to go up there, and if he had been under orders to see to it that I was taken upperside, there would have been no need to be so reluctant about it.
Is it reasonable to suppose he wanted you only for your mathematics? Did he discuss the mathematics with you? Did he make an attempt to explain his theory to you?
No, said Selden, he didn't. He did say something about going into it later on, though. The trouble was, he was totally involved with his instruments. I gathered he had expected sunshine that hadn't showed up, and he was counting on his instruments having been at fault. But they were apparently working perfectly, which frustrated him. I think this was an unexpected development that both soured his temper and turned his attention away from me. As for Clausia, the young woman who preoccupied me for a few minutes, I do not get the feeling as I look back on it that she deliberately led me away from the scene. The initiative was mine. I was curious about the vegetation on Upperside, and it was I who drew her away rather than vice versa. Far from Legan encouraging her action, he called her back while I was still in sight, and I moved farther away and out of sight, entirely on my own.
And yet,
said Hammond, who seemed intent on objecting to every suggestion that was made. If that ship was looking for you, those on board must have known you'd be there. How would they know, if not from Legan?
The man I suspect, said Selden, is a young psychologist named Lee Sung Randa.
Randa? Said Doris. I can't believe that. I know him. He simply would not be working for the Emperor. He's anti-imperialist to the core.
He might pretend to be, said Selden. In fact, he would have to be openly, violently, and extremely anti-imperialist if he was trying to mask the fact that he is an Imperial agent.
But that's exactly what he's not like, said Doris. He is not violent and extreme in anything. He's quiet and good-natured, and his views are always expressed mildly, almost timidly. I'm convinced they're genuine.
And yet, Doris, said Selden earnestly, it was he who first told me of the meteorological project. It was he who urged me to go upperside. And it was he who persuaded Legan to allow me to join him, rather exaggerating my mathematical prowess in the process. One must wonder why he was so anxious to get me up there, why he should labor so hard.
For your good, perhaps. He was interested in you, Harry, and must have thought that meteorology might have been useful in psychohistory. Isn't that possible?
Hammond said quietly, Let's consider another point. There was a considerable lapse of time between the moment when Randa told you about the meteorology project and the moment you actually went upperside. If Randa is innocent of anything underhanded, he would have no particular reason to keep quiet about it. If he is a friendly and gregarious person...
He is, said Doris.
Then he might very likely tell a number of friends about it. In that case... We couldn't really tell who the informer might be. In fact, just to make another point, suppose Randa is anti-imperialist. That would not necessarily mean he is not an agent. We would have to ask, whom is he an agent for? On whose behalf does he work?
Selden was astonished.
Who else is there to work for but the Empire? Who else but Demerzel?
Hammond raised his hand. You are far from understanding the whole complexity of Trantorian politics, Selden.
He turned toward Doris. Tell me again. Which were the four sectors that Dr. Legan named as likely sources for a meteorological vessel?
Pestalonia, Y, Ziggurath, and North Damiano.
And you did not ask the question in any leading way? You didn't ask if a particular sector might be the source.
No, definitely not. I simply asked if he could speculate as to the source of the jetdown.
And you, Hammond turned to Selden, may perhaps have seen some marking, some insignia on the jetdown.
Selden wanted to retort heatedly that the vessel could hardly be seen through the clouds, that it emerged only briefly, that he himself was not looking for markings, but only for escape. But he held back. Surely Hammond knew all that. Instead, he said simply, I'm afraid not.
Doris said, If the jetdown was on a kidnapping mission, might not the insignia have been masked?
That is the rational assumption, said Hammond, and it may well have been, but... In this galaxy, rationality does not always triumph. However, since Selden seems to have taken no note of any details concerning the vessel, we can only speculate. What I'm thinking is, why?
Why? Echoed Selden. I presume they wanted to take me because whoever was on the ship wanted me for my knowledge of psychohistory.
No, no. Hammond lifted his right forefinger as if lecturing a young student.
W-Y-E,
It is the name of a sector on Trentor, a very special sector. It has been ruled by a line of mayors for some 3,000 years. It has been a continuous line, a single dynasty. There was a time, some 500 years ago, when two emperors and an empress of the House of Wai sat on the imperial throne. It was a comparatively short period, and none of the Wai rulers were particularly distinguished or successful. But the mayors of Wai have never forgotten this imperial past. They have not been actively disloyal to the ruling houses that have succeeded them. But neither have they been known to volunteer much on behalf of those houses. During the occasional periods of civil war, they maintained a kind of neutrality, making moves that seemed best calculated to prolong the civil war and make it seem necessary to turn to Wai as a compromise solution. That never worked out, but they never stopped trying either. The present mayor of Wai is particularly capable. He is old now, but his ambition hasn't cooled. If anything happens to Cleon, even a natural death, the mayor will have a chance at the succession over Cleon's own too young son. The galactic public will always be a little more partial toward a claimant with an imperial past. Therefore, if the mayor of Wai has heard of you, you might serve as a useful scientific prophet on behalf of his house. There would be a traditional motive for Wai to try to arrange some convenient end for Cleon, use you to predict the inevitable succession of Wai and the coming of peace and prosperity for 1,000 years after. Of course, once the mayor of Wai is on the throne and has no further use for you, you might well follow Cleon to the grave. Selden broke the grim silence that followed by saying, "But we don't know that it is this mayor of Wai who is after me." "No, we don't. Or that anyone at all is after you at the moment. The jetdown might, after all, have been an ordinary meteorological testing vessel, as Legan has suggested. Still, as the news concerning psychohistory and its potential spreads, and it surely must, more and more of the powerful and semi-powerful on Trentor, or for that matter elsewhere, will want to make use of your services." "What then," said Doors, "shall we do?" "That is the question indeed." Hummin ruminated for a while, then said, "Perhaps it was a mistake to come here. For a professor, it is all too likely that the hiding place chosen would be a university. Streeling is one of many, but it is among the largest and most free, so it wouldn't be long before tendrils from here and there would begin feeling their soft, blind way toward this place. I think that as soon as possible, today perhaps, Selden should be moved to another and better hiding place. But..."
"But," said Selden,
"but I don't know where." Selden said, "Call up a gazetteer on the computer screen and choose a place at random."
"Certainly not," said Hummin. "If we do that, we are as likely to find a place that is less secure than average as one that is more secure. No, this must be reasoned out, somehow."
32. The three remained huddled in Selden's quarters till past lunch. During that time, Harry and Doris spoke occasionally and quietly on indifferent subjects, but Hummin maintained an almost complete silence. He sat upright, ate little, and his grave countenance, which Selden thought made him look older than his years, remained quiet and withdrawn. Selden imagined him to be reviewing the immense geography of Trentor in his mind, searching for a corner that would be ideal. Surely it couldn't be easy. Selden's own Helicon was somewhat larger by a percent or two than Trentor was and had a smaller ocean. The Heliconian land surface was perhaps 10% larger than the Trentorian.
But Helicon was sparsely populated, its surface only sprinkled with scattered cities. Trantor was all city. Where Helicon was divided into 20 administrative sectors, Trantor had over 800, and every one of those hundreds was itself a complex of subdivisions. Finally, Selden said in some despair, "Perhaps it might be best, Hummin, to choose which candidate for my supposed abilities is most nearly benign, hand me over to that one, and count on him to defend me against the rest." Hummin looked up and said in utmost seriousness, "That is not necessary. I know the candidate who is most nearly benign, and he already has you." Selden smiled. "Do you place yourself on the same level with the mayor of Y and the emperor of all the galaxy?" "In point of view of position, no. But as far as the desire to control you is concerned, I rival them. They, however, and anyone else I can think of, want you in order to strengthen their own wealth and power, while I have no ambitions at all, except for the good of the galaxy." "I suspect," said Selden dryly, "that each of your competitors, if asked, would insist that he too was thinking only of the good of the galaxy." "I am sure they would," said Hummin. "But so far, the only one of my competitors, as you call them, whom you have met, is the Emperor, and he was interested in having you advance fictionalized predictions that might stabilize his dynasty. I do not ask you for anything like that. I ask only that you perfect your psychohistorical technique so that mathematically valid predictions, even if only statistical in nature, can be made." "True. So far, at least," said Selden with a half-smile. "Therefore, I might as well ask, how are you coming along with that task? Any progress?" Selden was uncertain whether to laugh or rage. After a pause, he did neither, but managed to speak calmly. "Progress? In less than 2 months. Hummin, this is something that might easily take me my whole life and the lives of the next dozen who follow me, and even then end in failure." "I'm not talking about anything as final as a solution, or even as hopeful as the beginning of a solution. You've said flatly a number of times that a useful psychohistory is possible but impractical. All I am asking is whether there now seems any hope that it can be made practical." "Frankly, no." Doris said, "Please excuse me. I am not a mathematician, so I hope this is not a foolish question. How can you know something is both possible and impractical? I've heard you say that, in theory, you might personally meet and greet all the people in the Empire, but that it is not a practical feat because you couldn't live long enough to do it. But how can you tell that psychohistory is something of this sort?" Selden looked at Doris with some incredulity. "Do you want that explained?" "Yes," she said, nodding her head vigorously so that her curled hair vibrated. "As a matter of fact," said Hummin, "so would I." "Without mathematics," said Selden with just a trace of a smile. "Please," said Hummin. "Well," he retired into himself to choose a method of presentation. Then he said, "If you want to understand some aspect of the universe, it helps if you simplify it as much as possible and include only those properties and characteristics that are essential to understanding. If you want to determine how an object drops, you don't concern yourself with whether it is new or old, is red or green, or has an odor or not. You eliminate those things, and thus do not needlessly complicate matters. The simplification you can call a model or a simulation, and you can present it either as an actual representation on a computer screen or as a mathematical relationship. If you consider the primitive theory of non-relativistic gravitation, Doris said at once, "You promised there would be no mathematics. Don't try to slip it in by calling it primitive." "No, no, I mean primitive only in that it has been known as long as our records go back, that its discovery is shrouded in the mists of antiquity, as is that of fire or the wheel. In any case, the equations for such gravitational theory contain within themselves a description of the motions of a planetary system, of a double star, of tides, and of many other things. In any case, the equations for such gravitational theory contain within themselves a description of the motions of a planetary system, of a double star, of tides, and of many other things. Making use of such equations, we can even set up a pictorial simulation and have a planet circling a star or two stars circling each other on a two-dimensional screen, or set up more complicated systems in a three-dimensional holograph. Such simplified simulations make it far easier to grasp a phenomenon than it would be if we had to study the phenomenon itself. In fact, without the gravitational equations, our knowledge of planetary motions and of celestial mechanics generally would be sparse indeed. Now, as you wish to know more and more about any phenomenon, or as a phenomenon becomes more complex, you need more and more elaborate equations, more and more detailed programming, and you end with a computerized simulation that is harder and harder to grasp. "Can't you form a simulation of the simulation?" asked Tumman. "You would go down another degree." "In that case, you would have to eliminate some characteristic of the phenomenon which you want to include, and your simulation becomes useless. The LPS, that is, the least possible simulation, gains in complexity faster than the object being simulated does, and eventually the simulation catches up with the phenomenon. Thus it was established thousands of years ago that the universe as a whole, in its full complexity, cannot be represented by any simulation smaller than itself. In other words, you can't get any picture of the universe as a whole except by studying the entire universe. It has been shown also that if one attempts to substitute simulations of a small part of the universe, then another small part, then another small part, and so on, intending to put them all together to form a total picture of the universe, one would find that there are an infinite number of such part simulations. It would therefore take an infinite time to understand the universe in full, and that is just another way of saying that it is impossible to gain all the knowledge there is." "I understand you so far," said Doris, sounding a little surprised. "Well then, we know that some comparatively simple things are easy to simulate, and as things grow more and more complex, they become harder to simulate, until finally they become impossible to simulate. But at what level of complexity does simulation cease to be possible? Well, what I have shown, making use of a mathematical technique first invented in this past century, and barely usable, even if one employs a large and very fast computer, our galactic society falls short of that mark. It can be represented by a simulation simpler than itself. And I went on to show that this would result in the ability to predict future events in a statistical fashion. That is, by stating the probability for alternate sets of events, rather than flatly predicting that one set will take place." "In that case," said Hummann, "since you can profitably simulate galactic society, it's only a matter of doing so. Why is it impractical?" "All I have proved is that it will not take an infinite time to understand galactic society. But if it takes a billion years, it will still be impractical. That will be essentially the same as infinite time to us." "Is that how long it would take, a billion years?" I haven't been able to work out how long it would take, but I strongly suspect that it will take at least a billion years, which is why I suggested that number. But you don't really know. I've been trying to work it out. Without success? Without success. The university library does not help. Hummin cast a look at Doors as he asked the question. Selden shook his head slowly. Not at all. Doors can't help. Doors sighed. I know nothing about the subject, Cheddar. I can only suggest ways of looking. If Harry looks and doesn't find, I am helpless. Hummin rose to his feet. In that case, there is no great use in staying here at the university, and I must think of somewhere else to place you. Selden reached out and touched his sleeve. Still, I have an idea. Hummin stared at him with a faint narrowing of eyes that might have belied surprise or suspicion. When did you get the idea? Just now? No, it's been buzzing in my head for a few days before I went upperside. That little experience eclipsed it for a while. But asking about the library reminded me of it. Hummin seated himself again. Tell me your idea, if it's not something that's totally marinated in mathematics. No mathematics at all. It's just that reading history in the library reminded me that galactic society was less complicated in the past. 12,000 years ago, when the Empire was on the way to being established, the galaxy contained only about 10 million inhabited worlds. 20,000 years ago, the pre-imperial kingdoms included only about 10,000 worlds altogether. Still deeper in the past, who knows how society shrinks down? Perhaps even to a single world, as in the legends you yourself once mentioned, Hummin. Hummin said, And you think you might be able to work out psychohistory if you dealt with a much simpler galactic society? Yes, it seems to me that I might be able to do so. Then too, said Doris with sudden enthusiasm, suppose you work out psychohistory for a smaller society of the past, and suppose you can make predictions from a study of the pre-imperial situation as to what might happen 1,000 years after the formation of the empire. You could then check the actual situation at that time and see how near the mark you were. Hummin said coldly, Considering that you would know in advance the situation of the year 1000 of the galactic era, it would scarcely be a fair test. You would be unconsciously swayed by your prior knowledge, and you would be bound to choose values for your equation in such a way as to give you what you would know to be the solution. I don't think so, said Doors. We don't know the situation in 1000 GE very well, and we would have to dig. After all, that was 11 millennia ago. Selden's face turned into a picture of dismay. What do you mean we don't know the situation in 1000 GE very well? There were computers then, weren't there, Doors? Of course. And memory storage units and recordings of ear and eye? We should have all the records of 1000 GE as we have of the present year of 12,020 GE. In theory, yes, but in actual practice, well, you know, Harry, it's what you keep saying. It's possible to have full records of 1000 GE, but it's not practical to expect to have it. Yes, but what I keep saying, Doors, refers to mathematical demonstrations. I don't see the applications to historical records. Doris said defensively, Records don't last forever, Harry. Memory banks can be destroyed or defaced as a result of conflict, or can simply deteriorate with time. Any memory bit, any record that is not referred to for a long time, eventually drowns in accumulated noise. They say that fully 1/3 of the records in the Imperial Library are simply gibberish.
but of course, custom will not allow those records to be removed. Other libraries are less tradition-bound. In the Streeling